Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elec 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWBB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. We got a best of for you this week. We're revisiting some of our favorite interviews. This is a basketball show, so we've got books about Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan coming your way. So let's get right to it. Let's take a few minutes and talk with sports historian, Georgia Tech professor, and author of the book Jumpman, The Making and Meaning of Michael Jordan, Johnny Smith. Johnny, congrats on the book, and thanks for giving us some time to talk about it.
Oh, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
All right. So this book isn't really a biography. It's kind of about the making and the meaning of Michael Jordan. You're somebody who's written about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, somebody who's written about Muhammad Ali. Why did you decide to tell this version of Michael Jordan's story now?
Yeah, great question. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago in the 1980s and 1990s. Major Michael Jordan fan of Chicago Bulls. You know, I was one of those kids who wanted to be like Mike. And so his career in many ways shaped my youth, like a lot of kids growing up in the Chicagoland area. Oh, okay, great.
I'm not from Chicagoland, but he shaped my youth.
Yeah, sure.
Except for the part where Jason jumps.
You didn't have that type of influence on me, but I mean, I remember going to the Jordan Barkley games at the Spectrum when they battled in the playoffs in 90. And I mean, that's a memory that I have with my dad.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, you know, for me, he's always been a presence in my life. Well, fast forward, I became an academic historian. And as you said, I've written about several sports icons, many of them black athletes like Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and others. And for me as a historian, I've always been interested in how these famous black sports figures have shaped the black freedom struggle. You know, how did race change the way that they saw their role in relation, not just to sports, but to American culture? So as someone who grew up with Jordan being this great presence in my life, I thought, you know, if you follow the works of a lot of journalists who've written about Jordan, or even you watch The Last Dance, race is not really at the forefront of the conversation. So I wanted to better understand how race shaped the way that Jordan saw himself, how he presented himself in the public as an endorser for Nike and McDonald's and Chevrolet and Coca-Cola and these other companies, but also how race in the 1980s and 1990s shaped the way that we as the public, white Americans, black Americans, Americans of all different races and ethnicities saw Jordan. And I think there's a pivotal moment. The book follows this period between 1990 and 1991. And I think it's a crucial period in his life and career for two reasons. Number one, of course, that's the season the Bulls pursue their first championship. Jordan and the Bulls, they knock out Magic Johnson and the Lakers in the NBA Finals. It's the most watched NBA Finals in history up until that time. More than 70 countries are tuned in this satellite age. Hundreds of millions of people around the world are watching Jordan, and it's expanding the audience for MJ and for the NBA. And there's going to be consequences for him that I can talk about later. The other thing that's happening in 1991 after those finals is Gatorade launches the Be Like Mike Gatorade campaign. And if you watch that commercial closely, I think there's two crucial storylines that are emerging. You see Jordan surrounded by kids like us, you know, white kids, black kids, boys and girls. And the commercial is positioning basketball as America's game, as the democratic sport that is inclusive, that brings all kinds of kids from backgrounds onto the court. And it's Jordan who brings them there. Jordan is positioned as this unifying force, the racial unifier. And in studying Jordan's career, particularly in this period, what I came to see is that many Americans saw him as this great American hero who supposedly transcended race. But what I argue in the book is that this is part of the Jordan mythology. This young man who grows up in the South, who is confronted with racism, is harassed by, you know, white kids who hurl the N-word at him, could never truly transcend race. In fact, it's just the opposite. His experiences that he encounters in the South shaped the way that he saw sports. He thought that sports was going to be the ticket to get out of the South, to get out of Wilmington in the late 1970s. He internalized these messages and thought that, well, sports is this one space where I won't be denied, you know, that kids can't tell me that I'm less than or that I'm inferior because of the color of my skin. And so I want to explore that story, which is largely missing, I think, from the narratives that you see in The Last Dance.
So let's take a step back to 1984. You talk about in your book, 1984 and the Olympics, and how that brought Michael Jordan into our vision. Can you talk about how important the 1984 Olympics were to Michael Jordan and the Michael Jordan that we later come to know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, the 84 Olympics were hosted here in the United States in Los Angeles, and it was celebrated as this great patriotic moment. Remember, this is the Cold War. It's the rivalry between the U.S. and the Soviets, who refused to participate in the 84 Summer Games. And Jordan appears on the cover of Sports Illustrated. He is the face of Team USA. And it's his story that is seen as an American story. You know, he is the grandson of sharecroppers. He comes from this middle class Southern Christian family. And so I think that that imagery that is produced, that that's the moment when he starts to be described by sports writers as an American hero. And I think that's interesting because he's not described as a Black American hero. He's being described as an American hero. And this is an age in which political pundits, particularly more conservative Americans in the age of Reagan, they emphasize this idea of colorblindness, that race should not matter anymore. And even Jordan himself, as I write in the first chapter of the book, he embraces this idea. He tells reporters time and time again, you know, I don't want people to think of Michael Jordan as a Black man. I want them to see him as a person. And he would say things like, you know, I don't see you for your color. You know, I see you as a person. Now, however well-intentioned colorblindness may be, it is a problematic concept in the sense that the denial of race makes it a lot easier to deny racism. The denial of race makes it a lot easier for Jordan not to talk about race and not to remind people that he has had these experiences with racism that shape the way that he presents himself to the public. But of course, embracing colorblindness, that's part of David Stern's vision as well for the NBA. Because if you remember, from the late 70s to the early 1980s, critics would say that the league was quote unquote too Black, and the Black players were selfish and they were greedy in this age of free agency, and that there were these reports that they were using cocaine on just about every roster. You know, Jordan tells the famous story that when he was a rookie in 1984, the team goes to an exhibition game in Peoria, Illinois, and he's looking for his teammates in the hotel, and he knocks on the door, and the door opens, and he sees the white lines on a table, and he, you know, sprints out of there because he doesn't want to get caught up in that scene. Well, a lot of folks, when he told that story in The Last Dance, they thought, oh, this is the first time he's telling the story. It's not true. In the late 80s, he told the story as part of the Just Say No campaign that was organized by the Reagan administration. And it was important because that was where Jordan is saying that I'm not like them. You know, and this is my point, that racial transcendence is less about who you are than who you are not, right? He's positioning himself to be someone who is safe and non-threatening, and therefore that makes him someone who is who could be a role model, someone that you could look up to regardless if you're Black or white, because he was wholesome and he was a man of character. And those values mattered, particularly in the 1980s as the NBA is trying to rehabilitate its image.
I found it interesting that you noted that Jordan didn't differentiate, like he didn't want to focus on communities. It was just everybody should say no, not the Black community should say no. And that fit into this image that they were trying to sell. And you go into the role of David Falk doing that. He thought Jordan gained unbelievable exposure, but some of the stats were amazing. I think you had 5% of the league's 280 players were in national or TV print ads at the time. And the general feeling was they weren't marketable. Can you talk about Falk's approach where Nike was sort of the linchpin for that and pushing for the individual personality and the shoe line, which was different than the way that Black athletes had been marketed previously?
Yeah, the Nike deal is crucial. And you won't learn about this story in the motion picture Air, where we don't even see Michael's face. But David Falk, I think, was pretty sharp in understanding that he needed to sign a deal with Michael that was authentic. He always talked about authenticity, that it made the most sense for Jordan first to sign with a shoe manufacturer for a basketball shoe because he was a basketball player. He's going to be selling basketball shoes. Same thing that he signed a deal with. I think it was Wilson was his basketball, the company that signed Jordan. Authenticity, that's the key. Now, when Falk is trying to land this deal, keep in mind that in the sneaker endorsement business, Converse really has the biggest stars under contract. Magic Johnson, Julius Erving, Larry Bird, Isaiah Thomas. But they're not really highlighting them in individual campaigns. They all wear the same shoe, just in different colorways. So there was not this effort to focus on a singular athlete. But Phil Knight looks at the numbers and what he's paying all sorts of NBA players just to wear Nike shoes. No campaigns around these guys. And he thinks, there's no return for me. Why am I paying dozens of NBA players to wear Nike shoes? It's not helping us with sales. Nike is struggling financially. So there's a meeting of minds at Nike to build a campaign around a single individual. And the future of sports is going to be all about the cult of personality, building a movement around heroes. And I think that's what's really interesting about this period in the mid-80s, because Nike and Phil Knight and David Stern in the NBA, they have the same vision for marketing. They want to build their brands around individual heroes, creating heroes. And one of the things I tell my students about heroes, or cultural heroes, they serve a social function or a social purpose, and that is they're models to be emulated. And I think this is why our conversation around race is so important in MJ. It's that, you know, he becomes the template that if you want to land these endorsement deals, you can't be seen as militant. You can't be seen as outspoken. If you want to be a crossover star in the world of sports and entertainment, like an Eddie Murphy or a Whitney Houston or Bill Cosby during this era, well, you have to distance yourself then from these conversations. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that I mentioned in the book, there's very few Black sports agents. There was a perception that Black agents did not have access to corporate America. They couldn't land these deals. But David Falk was able to make this deal with Nike. Of course, it becomes an unprecedented deal. And then he's able to build on that. And he makes this case that to McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Chevrolet, that you three companies, you're going to benefit from Nike, because Nike's going to put Michael Jordan on television. He's going to be seen all across America, and you can draft off of that visibility. And so that enhances Jordan's marketability for those other companies who didn't have to take as much risk, since Nike was already carrying so much risk. But of course, in the end, it pays off for all of those companies. And for Falk, really what he likes about Coca-Cola and McDonald's in particular, and Nike, they're all companies that are exporting products overseas. And that's also something that's really important in understanding the Jordan phenomenon, is that the NBA and those companies, they're all becoming international. In the satellite age and in the cable age, they're going to be reaching more and more viewers from the late 80s into the early 90s.
You know, one of the characters that was around Michael Jordan in during his career is Jerry Krause. And you talked about the commonality that they found with each other, namely Jerry Krause experiencing anti-Semitism and Michael Jordan experiencing racism. Can you talk about that relationship, which also seems very complex?
Yeah, boy. You know, the Krause story is fascinating to me. When I was researching his background, you know, I learned that he had grown up in Chicago. He desperately wanted to become a somebody. You know, he goes on to be a scout in both basketball and baseball, and eventually becomes general manager of the Bulls, hired by Jerry Reinsdorf at a time when the sports writers in Chicago, I thought, you know, Jerry Krause, he had already been the GM actually once for the Bulls. People forget this. And it was a total disaster. But this is someone who I think was terribly insecure. And I think he was picked on as a kid, and he was picked on as an adult. He was always kind of seen by the beat writers as, you know, like the unathletic kid who follows the jocks around the high school. And that kind of reputation followed him even when he's a grown adult as the general manager of the Bulls. And, you know, when Kraus would meet with potential draft picks or free agents, black players, he would say, well, I can relate because I've experienced discrimination as a Jewish kid growing up in Chicago, which undoubtedly he did, experience anti-Semitism. However, one story that came up was a profile written by Rick Tellender in Sports Illustrated, where Kraus is quoted basically saying that he experienced horrific anti-Semitism in his high school. Well, after some of his former classmates at his high school read this profile, Jewish classmates, they wrote a letter to the editor and said, you know, Jerry Kraus is exaggerating. As fellow Jews in our high school, we had very good relationships to other kids. There was not rampant anti-Semitism in our school. And it raises all these questions that I wish, you know, we could ask Jerry Kraus if he was with us today. You know, well, why exaggerate? No doubt that I'm sure he encountered anti-Semitism at some point, but, you know, where does that come from? And I suspect there's some trauma in his youth that never goes away. There's just this void he wants to fill. And he talks about how, you know, he wants to win a championship for his dad. That's a really big thing for him. He's very connected to his father. So when Jordan comes to the Bulls and Kraus is the GM, there's the famous story that in 1986, Jordan has the broken foot and he's ready to go. And so he's playing these exhibition games back in Chapel Hill with college players. And Kraus finds out and he's, you know, pissed. So there's this heated meeting between Kraus and Reinsdorf on one side of the table and Jordan on the other side with David Falk. And at one point, Kraus says to Jordan, you know, you can't do whatever you want. You're Bulls property now. And when Jordan hears this, you're Bulls property now. You belong to us, these white executives. That crossed the line for Jordan, I think. And it was deeply offensive and insulting. And I try to contextualize that story to remind readers about the history of white executives in sports, you know, exploiting African-American athletes. And that tension never really goes away, even though we have integration in the 50s and 60s, and we have these collective bargaining agreements and black players led by Oscar Robertson had secured free agency. There's still a tension there that you work for us. It's not a partnership. But the thing I want to point out about Jordan is that this was someone who was deeply driven to assert his independence. And I think we see that in a lot of ways. He's not going to listen to Jerry Kraus. He's going to maintain autonomy over his body. He believes that he's going to control his destiny, and he asserts himself in that moment, and he never forgives Jerry Kraus. As we all know, Jordan will hang on to slights, real or imagined, forever, and he hangs on to that one. And so I think it's important for readers to understand, again, that there's this underlying racial tension there, I think, between Kraus and Jordan that hasn't been fully acknowledged.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned the time between 90 and 91 and the growth with Be Like Mike campaign and the finals dueling with Magic. He also had to deal with some social and political ramifications in that time. SI ran the cover on the sneaker murders in inner cities. He was asked to endorse in the North Carolina Senate race. Can you talk about his struggle in that time period to just keep being looked at as a person as opposed to a black person when it came to these circumstances?
Yeah, I think, you know, for all the statements about him transcending race, we find that in these two stories that you're raising here, that that's not really possible for Michael Jordan. In 1990, even before Sports Illustrated runs the cover story, Your Sneakers or Your Life, with, you know, someone holding a gun and grabbing these Air Jordan sneakers, the New York Post, Phil Mushnick, who's a columnist, wrote this story about how Spike Lee and Michael Jordan were responsible for marketing in their Nike commercials directly to inner city black kids who couldn't afford these Air Jordan sneakers. And they were to blame for all these supposed muggings and killings over Nike shoes. And it's really a fascinating story to think about on a number of levels, I think. The first question that comes to my mind as a historian is, okay, is this true? Were there all these muggings taking place? You know, okay, what's the evidence for this? So two things I did in trying to recreate this moment and doing my research. One is I used several newspaper databases and did comprehensive searches looking for as many articles as I could to document this supposed epidemic. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't find evidence that confirmed what Mushnick was telling his readers. Now, it doesn't mean that there weren't any muggings over sneakers in the cities and starter jackets. Undoubtedly, there were cases and they occurred, and we know some occurred in the inner city. But the other problem I found is that Richard Lapchick, who at that time was the director of the Sports and Society Institute at Northeastern University, he was asked this question in 1990, you know, how many of these so-called sneaker murders have there been? And he found between 1983 and 1990, only 8 cases where there was a murder linked to a sneaker robbery. And so this gives me pause to think about, okay, well, why the exaggeration? Why the hysteria? Well, I think we have to understand what else is going on in inner cities at that time. There is this growing fear of this supposed phenomenon of black on black crime, and that the inner cities are out of control. And there's these black youths who are running these violent gangs. And the latest thing that they want, it's not cars, it's these Air Jordan sneakers that have become these valuable totems of status. And so Jordan gets crossed up in this. He's asked about it. He's unprepared to deal with it. He doesn't know what to say. There's a legitimate case that he hears about where, in fact, in Maryland, a black teenager shot and killed another teenager and took his shoes. And that's the one that's featured in the Sports Illustrated story. But there's this incredible hysteria that takes place. And Jordan, I think, realizes that it's not enough for him just to set examples and be the role model. That's not going to be enough. He's going to have to really think about these issues that are happening in society. But the reality is he doesn't want to deal with them. Later that summer in 1990, Jesse Jackson, who at that time was the head of a civil rights group in Chicago, Jordan's hometown, called Operation Push. Well, Jesse Jackson organized a boycott of Nike, saying, look, Nike has all these black endorsers like Michael Jordan and Bo Jackson, but they don't have many black executives. They don't have black vice presidents, and they don't advertise in black magazines like Ebony and Jet or broadcast on BET. You know, so Michael, you know, you need to join us and push for change. Michael doesn't want any part of that either. And so in the summer of 1990, he basically stops talking about these issues. He goes abroad on this Nike tour with Sonny Vaccaro, and he puts on these basketball exhibitions for troops serving in Europe. And I think, you know, he really just hoped that this would go away. And by the time he shows up again in the public, it's the preseason for the Bulls in 1990. And that sort of becomes what he does. He retreats into himself. He's not comfortable in this role. Same thing with the Harvey Gantt. His mom wanted him to campaign for Gantt, donate to Gantt's election campaign in North Carolina. Jordan refuses. And I think, you know, it's easy to say that Jordan was simply protecting his brand. Some people will make that argument, but I actually think that there's more to it than that. I think that Jordan saw himself as part of a generation that didn't prioritize protests. That for him, his mindset was, my job is to make breakthroughs in other spaces, namely corporate America. And if I can break through in corporate America and set good examples and defy these stereotypes, well, then I'm contributing to racial progress in that way. And I think that was his mentality, that he's focusing on certain aspirations and shattering barriers in different ways. You know, being a voice, being a leader, he says, that's not who I am. In fact, in 1992, after the LA uprising, you know, the protests and the riots that take place there in response to the LAPD officers being exonerated for beating Rodney King, you know, Jordan is asked about this and he says, I'm not a leader. You know, this is not something for me to talk about. Magic Johnson wasn't saying anything either. You know, black stars in that time, they did not see themselves as voices for social change. That was not their role, at least not the role they embraced.
Look, we could talk to you all day, but we also know how busy you are because of how popular this book is. So I'm going to ask you a two-part question, and we only have about a minute left so you can get to your next interview. The role of the Medal of Freedom in Michael Jordan's life and culminating, what did that mean? And the last big question is, to you, having written the book and done the studies, what's bigger, Michael Jordan the person, the player, or the brand?
Okay. All right. So I'll try to answer these concisely, which I'm not good at. The medal from Barack Obama, you can see what it means to him because it moves him to tears. You know, it's an incredible moment. And if you hear how Jordan is introduced, it's about how he affected cultural change. And what's interesting is that Barack Obama gave the Medal of Freedom to two black basketball players. I think Kareem was in the same year as Jordan. You have to double check, but I know Obama also gave one to Kareem. But when he describes Kareem, he talks about how Kareem was a social conscience of America, that he took these important stands. So Barack Obama chooses these two basketball legends, gives them the Medal of Freedom for very different reasons, two men who represent very different eras. And of course, Kareem was one of those critics of Michael for being silent when it came to racism. So it's a really fascinating story that I try to explore, sort of the relationship between Jordan and Obama in the epilogue. And of course, remember too, Obama has arrived in Chicago when Jordan has arrived in Chicago. And so Chicago is really a defining place for both of them.
Yeah, Obama couldn't afford the tickets to go to the Bulls game.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I mean, watching him. And then he's giving him the Medal of Freedom at the White House.
I know. It's a great story. It's a fantastic story. And of course, Obama, of course, is a basketball enthusiast, a big part of his life. And the way that he saw race through basketball, the basketball court in Hawaii where he grew up was a place where he felt like he belonged, that his skin color wouldn't matter. I digress. To your other question, I would say the brand is more important than Jordan the person today. And here's why I would say that. You look around the world, the Jumpman logo is still everywhere. You know, you go to China, you go to parts of Europe, the Jumpman logo, people are still buying Air Jordans and Jumpman brand gear and apparel. But I don't think that there's this clamoring still to see Michael Jordan or to hear from Michael Jordan. And we're not going to get that. That brand is what allowed him to build enormous wealth, to become the first NBA player turned owner, who just sold his team, his majority stake of the Charlotte Hornets, for an estimated $3 billion. I think the brand, more than the man, made that. Because the man doesn't really give us a whole lot of himself. That's the mystique that I talk about in the book. And if you watch The Last Dance, he doesn't want to let us into his private world. We don't learn about, you know, what it was like in his home when he's playing for the Bulls. We don't see Juanita. We don't see his kids. We see his dad, of course, and his mom in the early part of the story. But, you know, he doesn't let us into his private space. And Air, the motion picture Air, you know, it reinforces that theme. He's not even in the movie. We just get the back of his head. You know, you can't tell me that's not also intentional.
How you know the brand is big that you don't even have to show the guy. You just show the back of his head.
Exactly.
It's for a movie. The book is Jumpman, The Making and Meaning of Michael Jordan. You should get it. You absolutely will not regret it. Johnny, thanks so much for the time and best of luck with the book.
Oh, great to meet you both. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
We're lucky to get some time with Roland Lazenby. Let's talk about his new book, Magic, The Life of Irvin Magic Johnson. Roland, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you, Jason and Jeffrey. You guys doing all right?
We got no complaints. I mean, look, we're in Philadelphia, so we've had a week with sports. Yeah. We figured right onto basketball and just leave that baseball in the rearview mirror.
Are you sure you want to do that?
Well, if you don't want to talk basketball, I have a really stupid question to ask you. And I admit that it is stupid, but your name is not a common last name. And so I got to ask whether or not anybody ever asked you if you were related to the original James Bond, George Lazenby.
Well, let's see. My first name is Roland. You could also ask me how many times I've had people sing Rollin' on the River to me.
Oh, God.
Which started, you know, in early high school whenever Creedence brought that out. Yeah, I've been asked about the Lazenby connection a lot. And I will tell you that Jack Kent Cook told me once that I didn't know how to pronounce my own last name.
Most importantly, what was your response? And can you say that on the air?
I said, well, my father pronounced it Lazenby. I admitted to him, we're hillbillies down here in the sticks of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the western part of Virginia. So who knows what that originated at? It's a English name. There's a village, Lazenby. I don't know if it's Lazenby or what, but I'm not really particular about how people pronounce my name. It would have been an immense waste of time to have cared much about that.
All right. Well, now we're going to make you talk a little basketball. Jason, why don't you take it?
Good. Oh, I was just referring to the Sixers. I mean, of all the heartaches in Philadelphia.
Yeah. We have another one with the Phillies right now, but we're about to start the one with the Sixers. Go ahead.
That's what I'm speaking about. Of all the heartaches in Philadelphia, then to have to turn around and face.
It was great. The Phillies season ended and they sent James Harden home. It's just exactly what we wanted to move on to here in Philadelphia.
When are you gonna write the book on the process? You've written about all these other great teams. When are you gonna write the book on the process?
I've got to do a Stern project. I've got to do a LeBron project. I'm 71. These are fun. I just ruptured my quad, so I'm suddenly. For the first time, really contemplating my mortality and if I should retire, but I don't think I will. I enjoy too much.
Well, you've now written over 30 biographies and memoirs. You've written about some of the greats in the game, from Michael Jordan to Kobe, Jerry West. Why Magic and why now?
It just happened to be the order in which publishers would take them. I got to know Magic a fairly good bit. I mean, in some ways nobody ever gets to know Magic, especially not media people. Some have, but I mean, he's so friendly and accessible. And so that was easy in 89, 90 when I was first getting to know him. But I ended up spending a lot more time with the Bulls. And so I got to know that whole group of Jordan and everybody, especially Tex Winter. And coming out of that, I really moved back, started doing Lakers projects. I got to know Kobe. I spent a lot of time with him as a young player. And, from the early stuff, Jerry West had been my old man's hero, so that was something I wanted to write. My old man was one of these old two-handed set shooters out of the hills of southern West Virginia, a basketball nut. Anyway, and I wanted to do Magic in there, but even before Kobe. But, analytics hadn't just infected sports. It's also infected publishing. And so Little Brown, my publisher at the time, was worried that there weren't enough internet searches for Magic. And so Macmillan, my current publisher, had no such concerns. They knew Magic would be a very important story to tell. And, I think it's a phenomenon of the age, and Magic played a major role in it, that nobody gave a hoot about American professional basketball. Now, Eddie Gottlieb there in Philly made a good run at it. You know, he had ways. He played Jumpin' Joe Foulkes, who became the game's first 20-point scorer with the old Warriors. He played Jumpin' Joe Foulkes enough to run up the points. When Wilt came along, he played him all but 4 minutes of the whole damn season at one point there to make sure those numbers were high. He knew what the NBA learned today. You got to jack up the game so that people score lots of points, so that they get on their phones and they're all engaged. But somewhere in the middle, starting about 79, when David Stern began, this lawyer from Proskauer on Times Square, began gaining power and was getting ready to have a coup d'etat at the NBA and take charge of things. And here come Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And they've already got the esteemed Dr. J. There's this flood of talent coming into the game that can really actually get something. And right behind them, here comes Michael Jordan. And suddenly the NBA realizes what Eddie Gottlieb knew in Philly years before, that it's about the players, and you've got magnificent players. You gotta sell that. And the NBA went from a game where they couldn't sell tickets. They had to book doubleheaders with the Harlem Globetrotters to get people to come. It went to this game that now the whole world has this love affair with NBA superstars. My Michael Jordan book, which came out from Little Brown in 2014, is in 21 languages. The 21st happened just this week with Portuguese. The Kobe Bryant book I did is in 12. Magic is already signed up for 7 languages. And, you know, these are not easy things. My Magic books, I'm an idiot. It's 800 pages. Who publishes an 800? And Jordan was 700 and some pages. And so that tells you the love and care these foreign publishers have. And they've sold a lot of copies of these books. And nobody gives a hoot who I am. I'm as big a zero in the equation as you could be. But they love American basketball superstars.
You know, you mentioned 800 pages. You really go all the way back. I mean, you go to his great-great-grandfather, but coming ahead, you interviewed his high school basketball coaches more than 50 times each. I didn't know about Magic's history with the Lansing busing situation and his brother basically being kicked off the team that he ended up playing on for being Black. Can you talk about how Magic, even as an early age, was on the cutting edge of community issues?
Yes, and thank you for stopping me on that run. I wax poetic about the great overview of the NBA, but I really have spent time on this book and the nuts and bolts of, and it was Magic. It was really how we integrated around basketball, which I think is an important American story. But I was a varsity head coach at age 24 in that era. And I coached a lot of impressive kids. But the Magic I discovered in looking for the organic early years of his life, I'm going to tell you, he was a really impressive kid from an impressive family. And, you know, he just did so many things right. He had difficulties. He had reading difficulties. He worked to overcome those at a young age. He had diction difficulties. He worked to overcome those. And none of that really mattered or held him back. He had such a vast emotional gift. And in addition to all the athletic skills, I mean, that's... And so the people running the Lansing schools, faced with all this violence, particularly at Everett High School, that had dragged on not 1 year, 2 years, several years. And they just knew that he would come in and change things. And before he ever played a game at Everett High School, the principal called him in and said, "We need you to help, you know, calm this situation down, sort this out." And Magic said, how in the heck am I going to do that? I'm 15 years old and had just turned 15. And the principal said, you'll figure it out. And, you know, that's pretty much how he fit into that. And the good things that happened really came out of his sort of uncompromising stewardship. You know, when you think about it, he was ceded all this power by the school administration, but then he turned around and held that same administration to task on practical issues about racial integration. Like, how about playing a little black music in the cafeteria? How about having a few black cheerleaders? And so even at 15, he was standing up to the same people that he was working with, but he did it his own way.
Magic is an international star, always has been. How is it that you were able to bring out these stories and stories about the magic behind the scenes that a lot of us just didn't know? Magic seems to, his aura has always been this guy with this infectious smile and this positive attitude. And while all of that is there, there is also below the surface, this strength, this quiet strength that he seems to have. And in not even, you know, tooting his own horn about all the stuff that you write about in your book.
At the same time, an immense control freak. I mean, it's a wonder to me that he didn't want to be a coach because he is such a control freak. But yes, you know, it's complicated. The same thing was true with Michael Jordan, the life. There was this rich story, this backstory, you know, and both Magic's mother and Michael's mother come out of the sharecropping culture in North Carolina that was just brutal. And it was, you know, there in the agricultural world, the state that had more Ku Klux Klan members than all the other southern states combined. But, you know, people marveled at it. Nobody had really spent a lot of time talking to George Fox or Pat Holland. And Magic was always pretty big about controlling his own narrative. And I mean, fiercely, I talked to his mother, had a lovely conversation with his mother at the 1992 All-Star Game in Orlando. And I went over to tell Magic about it. And he looked at me very seriously and said, she shouldn't be telling you my secrets. And when I really, you know, to research a biography, you get into every phase. And I realized he had at one point 10 siblings, all kinds of family members all over America. And you never hear a peep out of any of them. And he is that kind of control freak. Now, we all want to control our narratives. And we all want to, you know, keep our image headed in the right direction. But it's so far beyond that with Magic Johnson. He controlled his coaches. He controlled the way the game was played. As Dale Beard, his teammate in high school, told me, a guy who was the best man at Magic's wedding, he said, I couldn't play my game. I had to play the way Magic wanted me to play, or I was going to sit on the bench. And that level of control freak combined with this tremendous emotional intelligence and this, I mean, you just have to admire his humanity and his ability with people is just, it's beyond rare and uncommon. And so you have to admire all that, but you have to wonder at it too.
You know, you talk about his desire for control, and the book is interesting because it's balanced. It's not just a puff piece on Magic. It talks about the warts and the flaws that he went through. But at the same time, Jerry West said to you that you can see what people do on the floor, but you can't read their heart. You've said the crux of this book shows how Magic was a function of his heart. Can you talk more about that side of it?
Yeah, because, you know, nobody saw that. And Jerry West reveal that to me in a 1990 conversation, looking back on Magic's career and also looking at the nature of talent scouting. Jerry West, of course, a great talent who then became a great talent scout. But he was telling me that. And Dr. Jack Ramsey, the great coach, obviously, the Portland Trailblazers and also of college fame in the Philadelphia area, told me in 2004, you know, I didn't think Magic could work as a pro point guard. And he talked about how Portland, you know, because of his weak left hand, they just victimized him all that freshman year. But it was almost like those reading troubles in sixth grade for Magic. He took that weak left hand, and the next year he came back, as Dr. Jack pointed out, those weaknesses weren't there. And he's had that drive. And Billy Packer said basically the same thing without really knowing about what Jerry West had told me. You know, Billy Packer, my dear friend who also has passed on since I interviewed him for the book, and Billy and I have done 5 books together. But Billy talked about being a broadcaster for that great Final Four game against Indiana State and Larry Bird and Michigan State and Magic. And he said, none of us, and we were the broadcast team in college basketball, Al McGuire, Dick Unberg, none of us thought that Magic Johnson or Larry Bird, for that matter, would really be able to do anything in pro basketball. And what we did not understand, as Billy says, we had no idea of the heart of either one of those guys, but especially the heart of Magic Johnson.
You know, it seems you mentioned Michael Jordan earlier. It seems that Magic and Michael were very similar internally, but to the outside world, Magic and Michael are seen very differently. Michael is seen as kind of this cold competitor, while Magic, even though he was just as much a competitor, always had this smile and air of enjoying the game more.
Yeah, it believe me, it irritated opponents plenty. But you could see, Bine, you could see his eyes weren't smiling all the time. I mean, he had the natural smile, but there were a lot of processors going on. He was doing a lot of calculating, and it was not it was not entirely selfish, or maybe even selfish at all, but his calculating was about winning. And Michael Jordan's hero as a high school junior and senior was Magic Johnson, to the point that Michael Jordan began calling himself Magic Mike, and his girlfriend bought a vanity plate for his first car, Magic Mike. And Michael Jordan really was trying to learn to throw no-look passes in high school practice each day. He thought he would be a point guard. And he got to UNC, and Dean Smith said, lose the Magic Mike, supposedly. There's only one Magic. And, that obviously was the beginning of a very interesting timeline for those two, a timeline that carries on pretty strongly today. They're still competing like madmen in the commercial race, in the boat race for commerce and business. And it might be a canoe race, and Magic's in the canoe and he's 100 yards back and paddling furiously, maybe a quarter mile back.
You know, you've watched and you track it in this book, the game change through the years. But you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, they sort of were the start of making the NBA more fun, which has now continued into the personalities and the individualism in the NBA. Can you talk about how Magic and Larry and Michael, you know, these players you've written about, sort of the leading edge of the NBA that we see today?
Well, yeah, you know, they did it. David Stearns, you know, recognized that. He didn't know that it was going to be Larry and Magic, but when it happened, you know, he soon enough moved in place to become commissioner. He really opened up things to grow the NBA globally. He grew the NBA as a professional organization. He really focused on marketing and things. Larry O'Brien, the former commissioner before David Stern, did some of the things to create the merger of the NBA and the ABA. But he really was a function of the Kennedy administration and Camelot. And he really didn't have his focus on the modern NBA. It was by 79, the regular TV ratings had dropped 25%. As we know, the great Game 6 in Philadelphia in the 1980 championship series between the Lakers and the Sixers was on tape delay. And the teams were losing lots of money. The NBA was not in good shape. Pro basketball had never been robust in any sense. But David Stern knew to focus on these great players, and it became a succession. Jordan followed right in line, and all of this stuff began to blow up. The 92 Dream Team was a red letter mark. Here comes Kobe and all of his competitions. And just the love and focus, when you look at how downtrodden, how victimized and put upon Black males were in our culture, in our history. And then to see them become these basically global warrior figures. Now, they weren't like samurai cutting people's heads off, but they were warriors all the same. That's why they're loved in Japan, China, Italy. I could go through all the countries that have printed and reprinted these books about these guys. And that reversal is an astounding and wonderful and important thing for our world. And it's multifaceted. It's not just basketball, but basketball is a big part of it. And Magic played such a role in that. The thing I find so disheartening is how the game has been intentionally changed and has moved away from a lot of that. Now, it's swinging back around a little bit. But a lot of the things that brought us this special appreciation are really no longer allowed in today's game. And so you wonder if a generation of players like the ones we've discussed, Larry and Magic and Michael and Kobe and those guys came along, I think they'd be great in any era. But the way the game is played today, I don't know. We're about to see. We're seeing remarkable young players in today's NBA. I'm just not sure if certain powerful figures didn't sort of juice the game of basketball for their own designs, and we've ended up with a much more flawed product. I'm not sure of that yet. I may just be some old guy grumbling. So we'll have to reserve judgment on that. But I wonder and worry about that because I do love basketball.
You know, Roland, we have a couple minutes left, and one of the things that does come across in your book is not just Magic on the court, not just Magic as an international figure, but Magic as a business person. And it seems like Magic, Michael, those players from that generation were able to monetize is one word, but able to build upon the career that they had on a court to building businesses in communities. What have you learned from talking to people about Magic, about the movie theaters, about everything else that he's done, about Magic the mind?
I had fascinating conversations with Peter Guber, who was chairman of Sony in the early Sony USA in the early 90s. They were building theaters. He gets a call from Magic Johnson, who wants a meeting, and these two Black guys show up at the meeting, Magic Johnson and his money guy, who is a really, really sharp money guy. And they propose that there's this great overlook, a segment of the market black neighborhoods where Sony should build theaters. Goober was quite taken with the presentation. The money people from Sony looked at it up and down, said, hell yeah. And that was Magic's first big success in the business world. And it was substantial. You know, he later went on and sold those theaters and has moved on to just an absolute whirlwind, of business enterprise. He's got every kind of business operation you can imagine, insurance companies, all kinds of contracting companies, all of it aimed at elevating economic opportunity for Black Americans. And that is part of his great mission. And it is very impressive. The nuts and bolts of it are very impressive. And it makes this, I mean, it's a great basketball story, but it's so much bigger. The fact that he was HIV positive, that he really was out of control. That's a function of that whole climate in the 1980s in Los Angeles and frankly all over the place. But he became caught up in having lots and lots and lots of unprotected sex. It really made him an unliked figure. People wept when he resigned abruptly, but as the story came out and he was seemingly too eager to talk about it, it became a great negative, but it didn't matter. He was able to, this great emotional intelligence and humanity that he possessed enabled him, and his great drive and heart enabled him to overcome all of that and to make the kind of gains and to create the kind of example that make this a truly great American story, one that took me 800 pages to tell.
Well, and we encourage people to pick up that book, read all 800 pages to learn the story for themselves. The book is Magic, The Life of Irvin Magic Johnson. Roland Lazenby, thank you so much for the time. We wish you the best of luck with the book and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you for your extremely thoughtful questions and slowing me down on a day when I'm going much too fast. You guys have a great day.
Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.